Our book of the week. Exploring the history and development of forensic science, Forensics, the Anatomy of Crime is written and read by the best-selling author Val McDermott. In this final extract, she looks at the ways in which forensic psychologists can offer valuable insights into the criminal mind.
For the writer of fiction, understanding the motivation of our characters is at the heart of what we do. So the forensic psychologist offers us the perfect fantasy figure. Someone who looks at people with an analytical and empathetic eye, but who also gets to be the hero. When I first had the idea for my novel The Mermaid Singing, the debut of offender profiler Dr. Tony Hill, the man I turned to for help was Dr. Mike Berry. Mike Berry is a psychologist who became involved in offender profiling just as the UK police started taking it seriously. He worked for many years at the sharp end, treating patients in secure mental hospitals. "It's a challenge," says Mike, "but it's also very draining because you're dealing with sometimes very horrific offences." Once he has visited the scene of the crime, Mike studies photographs and police notes, witness accounts, the autopsy report and photographs, and any other relevant information he can get his hands on. At this stage, it's important that the police keep suspect details to themselves, so the profiler is not influenced by the investigator's preconceptions. The next stage happens inside his head. "I sit at a blank screen and think as part of developing the initial hypothesis to build up a profile. I go for walks and talk it over in my head, and occasionally if there's somebody I work with who I trust, I bounce ideas off them. Then it goes to the rejection model. I set up a model, and the whole time I'm looking at trying to reject it, asking myself, where's the evidence for that? You can work on something for several hours, and then something says no, so you throw it out." Just as law-abiding citizens tend to go back to the same street to do their shopping time and again, most criminals like to commit their crimes in the same areas. David Cantor, an environmental psychologist at the University of Surrey, came up with a circle hypothesis. If you draw a circle with a circumference going through the sites of the two crimes furthest apart from each other, the culprit's home will likely be near the centre of that circle. Research has shown this to be true of the majority of criminals who strike more than five times. Cantor has found that a serial killer can usually be found living within a triangle formed by the sites of his first three murders. He has developed a computer program called the Dragnet, which generates hotspots. Rather than attempting to mark a killer's home with an X, Dragnet produces areas showing where he's likely to live, colour-coded from the highest probability to the lowest. Mike Berry says, "Some people still have a false image of profiling. They think that the profiler's going to come along and say, he's left-handed, ginger-haired, 5'6", and supports Man City. But more people see it now as a tool in the detective tool bag, similar to DNA and pathology. It's very much a tool rather than a major source of information, and I think that's right." Psychologists have also studied the art of the interview and have come up with some key points for detectives to follow. They need to build an open atmosphere with their subjects. Ask open questions which can't be answered with yes or no. Avoid cutting the subject off in mid-flow. And be interested in every point they make, even if it appears irrelevant. Although everyone's different, encouraging interviewees to tell the truth often comes down to the elusive qualities of trust and respect. The other proven technique of getting a suspect to confess is to make sure that they're fully aware of the weight of the evidence against them. But contrary to the movies, a coercive approach can lead interviewees either to shut down or to make false confessions. And of course, in these days of recorded interviews, any attempt at coercion will see the evidence thrown out in the courtroom. Forensic psychologists are also increasingly involved in psychological autopsy. They look at diaries and emails, online activity, and the mental health history of the deceased's family. Psychologists generally agree that factors outside a killer's control, such as their upbringing and heredity, can have a defining effect on the way they behave as adults. American neuroscientist James Fallon studied the brains of several convicted serial killers and noticed that many showed lower than average levels of activity in the areas of the frontal lobe linked to empathy, morality, and self-control. In an attempt to quantify the differences between them and the general population, Fallon mixed the brain scans in with scans he'd taken of his own family members. The scan that shouted, "Psychopath!" loudest was his own. He decided to investigate further by testing his own DNA. The outcome was even more unsettling. I had all these high-risk alleles for aggression, violence and low empathy. Seriously concerned by now, Fallon did some digging into his genealogy. In branches of his family tree, he found 7 alleged murderers, among them the source of the notorious rhyme. Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. In his 2013 book, The Psychopath Inside, Fallon says, "It's not a death sentence, the biology, but it will give you some high potential for these things. The genes load the gun and make someone vulnerable to becoming a psychopath." Looking for answers to his own lack of criminality, Fallon decided he owed his non-violence to his mother's love and thanked her from the bottom of his heart. The courtroom. Trial by jury has its roots in ancient Greece and Rome and began in England in 1219. As their powers increased, the jury came to be seen as a pillar of society. A group of your equals could condemn you to jail, but a wigged member of the establishment could not. By the 18th century, the law recognised that juries were there to limit the state's ability to lock up the people it didn't like. The Crown Prosecution Service is an organ of state. Its links with the police give it a head start on the defence, but it must share all its findings with the other side before a trial. The principle of sharing evidence has to do with the legal concept of equality of arms, whereby similar resources must be available to the prosecution and the defence. Without equality of arms, a fair trial is impossible. Equality of arms means that, in theory, both the prosecution and the defendant should have access to their own expert witness to give a view on what the evidence means. Cross-examination can strengthen forensic techniques by putting pressure on them. If the evidence is sound, the theory goes, jurors will find it all the sounder once they've seen it flexed. Forensic entomologist Martin Hall says, "Cross-examination is always a nervous time. The heart beats a bit quicker. Your professional opinion is called into question." Some scientists think that the kind of intense scrutiny lawyers currently put on them would be better directed. As one says, "I've had a defence solicitor say to me, 'Well, you know, we know he's guilty of sin, but it's our job to catch you out.' That's the thing that offends me more than anything. No, it's not their job to catch us out. Their job is to look at the evidence." A good lawyer will always look for the weakest link in a case, and sometimes that is the victim. A Canadian defence lawyer once gave his colleagues a savage piece of advice. "If you destroy the complainant in a prosecution, you destroy the head. You cut off the head of the Crown's case, and the case is dead." Fiona Raitt, Professor of Evidence and Social Justice at the University of Dundee, has worked with Rape Crisis, helping victims of rape or sexual assault take their cases to court. For the sake of equality of arms, the defence lawyer of an accused rapist must have access to all of the same medical records of the complainant as the prosecution lawyer. "Women are shocked when they find out," explains Fiona. "They think, 'How did they get that?' The defence lawyer will say, 'Is it the case that you were on tablets, let's see, your tranquilizers about 3 years ago because you had a bout of mental health issues?' And before you know it, they're creating a story of this uncredible person who probably can't remember very well and who perhaps is still taking tablets. For one reason or another, the most vulnerable witnesses are the ones with the longest medical records, and the defence have a field day. Complainants do have the right to refuse to pass over their records, but they often don't, because they haven't properly grasped the significance of revealing them." When Louise Ellison, Professor of Law at the University of Leeds, set up a mock jury of 40 members of the local community and got actors and barristers to reenact rape trials in front of them, she found that jurors were influenced by the demeanour of the complainant in court, whether emotional or composed, and by how long after the rape the complainant had reported it. When a judge or an expert explained how varied reactions to an unwanted sexual approach could be, however, the jury was less likely to be put off giving a guilty verdict, either because of a calm demeanour or a delay in reporting the rape. Judges have to be careful about intervening, because if it seems even slightly that they're taking sides, the verdict of the trial can be overturned at the Court of Appeal. The idea that jurors should be left to make up their own minds is the cornerstone of any adversarial criminal justice system. But juries do not always get it right. A 2014 study by legal experts and statisticians from Michigan and Pennsylvania found that 4.1% of prisoners sentenced to death in America were innocent. In the course of researching this book, I've been struck above all by the integrity, ingenuity, and generosity of the forensic scientists I have met. They care so deeply about the cases they work on that they're willing to engage with the darkest and most frightening aspects of human behaviour on a daily basis, to spend hours in the sodden debris of a fatal fire, to collect maggots from a week-old corpse, to reconstruct the face of a mutilated child. They make sacrifices so that the rest of us can live knowing that if we are the victims of crime, the perpetrators will be brought to justice. They do not guard their knowledge jealously. They share it as widely as possible in the hope that one of their colleagues may use it as a springboard for the next leap forward. Crime scene evidence would not be so effectively utilised today if it hadn't, for more than 200 years, been forced to pass the strict credibility tests of the courtroom. However personally stressful a forensic scientist may find giving testimony, the courtroom is the anvil on which scientific evidence is struck. With a well-prepared lawyer playing the part of the hammer, forensic techniques are either strengthened or broken, according to their merit. Yet because forensic science is made up of so many human layers, criminals, eyewitnesses, police officers, CSIs, scientists, lawyers, judges, juries, it cannot avoid either missing or misrepresenting the truth at times. The stakes are always high. Life and liberty depend on it. I hope this book has demonstrated the commitment of forensic scientists across the disciplines to be imaginative, open-minded, and painstakingly honest in the interests of justice for all of us. It has certainly reminded me of what I have known for a long time. The work itself is amazing, and the people who do it are, frankly, awesome.
Val McDermott was reading from her new book, Forensics, The Anatomy of Crime. It was abridged by Sian Preece and produced by Allegra McElroy. And if you've missed any of the earlier episodes in the series, you can listen to them on BBC iPlayer Radio, where they'll be available for a month. And we continue the criminal trend next week.
What happens in a society? Are crimes really punished? What is democracy? Does it really work?
BBC Radio 4 examines crime fiction across the globe.
It's one of the best forms you can use, I think, to address issues in society, especially in a developing society like Nigeria.
A new series of Foreign Bodies starts with the Cuban author Leonardo Padura and his series The Havana Quartet.
The novels try to be a mirror of the Cuban society in the 90s. That was a very complicated period here in Cuba.
Foreign Bodies with Mark Lawson, next Monday to Friday at 1:45.
And we begin a dramatisation of the Havana Quartet tomorrow afternoon at 2:30 with the first story, Havana Blue. After the news, Jenny Murray will be talking to the traditional Irish folk singer Cara Dillon. First, though, a quick look ahead to tomorrow evening when Ruby Tando tells A Girl's Own Story.
For decades, us girls have had little or no say in how we're represented. Others have been quick to speak on our behalf and just as quick to dismiss us out of hand. But now more than ever, we're seizing control of our own image. We're punching through all those distortions that paint us as passive, as naive, and as vulnerable. We are inventing ourselves, and we're taking what is rightfully ours. Join me, Ruby Tando, for A Girl's Own Story tomorrow evening at 8:00 and after that on the Radio 4 website.